This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you all, for, especially those of you who've stuck with us throughout the day, but also thank you to anyone who is new. We're excited to have you here. This is the culmination of a series of conversations we've been having, and the question I've gotten most frequently probably is, what is your panel about? And we're going to create that together now. Yeah. The secret is we're going to make it what we want it to be, which is freeing. I have questions to guide us, but your expertise is why we have you here. We're excited to hear what you have to offer.
Hi, I'm Bill Kirkpatrick. I teach at Denison University in Ohio. And I would pick up on a couple things that Karen said in her introduction. One was corporate control of policy. And one of my contributions to the panel will be to look at the way in which that might be true at a national level, but there are a lot of ways, a lot of places in which that intersection of content and conduit is not controlled by corporations or at the federal level. For example, the student who is suspended for posting something vulgar to Facebook. Right? So there are a lot of policymakers throughout, you know, throughout different levels of society that I think have control over the content and the conduits. You know, what are we going to filter in the school library and that sort of thing. So that would be one. But also picking up on what you said at the end there is places for action. That also means that the federal level is not the only place where we can affect important change. The other contribution that I hope to make is to move in the other direction, the non-policy relevant direction, which is to kind of step back and see policy not in terms of specific policies, but more what policy does to us and for us as a society. And an example there would be earlier today, it was said that they are attempting to eradicate the porn industry. And on the one hand, that looks true. On the other hand, there are ways in which actually, no, they don't want to kill it. They only want to wound it. That keeping it around provides useful enemies, useful subtexts, useful structuring others for policy decisions and content and conduit infrastructure decisions that are happening far, far away from, say, the adult entertainment space.
My name is Phil Napoli. I am a faculty member in the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers University. Before that, I was at Fordham University, where for a decade I directed something called the Donald McGannon Communication Research Center, which was a research center focused on linking policy research with public interest advocacy. And we collaborated with organizations ranging from the Minority Media and Telecommunications Council, the Center for Creative Voices and Media, Center for American Progress, New America Foundation, and that's been my sort of primary, you know, area of interest, even from a research standpoint, as of late, is the role that research plays in policymaking and policy advocacy, how research is used and abused corrupted in many cases. So I don't know. Did you want us to get into the specifics of thoughts on the merger too, as well? At this point,
well, let's introduce first, and then we'll come around.
Okay. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jackie Selby. I'm a PhD candidate at USC's Annenberg School for Communication. And before that, I was a senior researcher at an open source intelligence contractor in DC. So you can kind of say I've gone from the dark side to the ivory tower. Anyway, my research currently is on internet intermediary liability. For those students in the room whose eyes just glazed over, I like to call this the internet middlemen. So what this means is that much of the internet is made up of internet platforms that are connecting content creators to content users. And they have great power as gatekeepers, which means that they're also huge targets for liability, for people who want to sue them in order to control user behavior and information traffic. Now, the best way to understand this is a little story that I'll tell, where in 2006, in Turin, Italy, there were four boys who bullied their autistic classmate and actually uploaded a video of this to YouTube. Now, obviously, this did not fly, and within minutes, there were people complaining to YouTube. YouTube took it down within an hour, and then Google helped the government of Italy to try to find these children who later got suspended, and that would seem to be the end of the story. However, when this went to court, the Italian courts ruled in 2010 that, in fact, because YouTube makes money from advertising revenue, it is their responsibility to pre-screen all of the content that goes onto YouTube, all of it. That's, what is that, 72 hours a minute in recent statistics, to make sure that none of it is indecent for children and none of it is slanderous and that it is screened at proper hours of the day. So think about that and the future of internet governance.
Okay, I'm Tom Streeter from the University of Vermont. I live in Burlington, Vermont, where I have a fiber to the home internet connection owned by the city of Burlington, a municipally run system that, like he said, the fastest system in the, in, you cannot get anything like what I have from Comcast in Vermont. Well, I believe that change, big change, is possible. I'm sort of a believer in Raymond Williams' long revolution, qualified by Stuart Hall's phrase, without guarantees. But that means, I think, in the long term, on the level of change over decades or more rather than years, or I'm interested in that kind of change. And so, you know, some of the ideas, I'm very interested in the fact that, that we have this panel about, and this whole conference that's talking about reframing boundaries and rethinking the kind of larger ways in which we organize our efforts. And I do have some ideas. I think, for example, we need to talk about the pre-formal modes of policymaking. I think Bill was sort of referencing to this, but I think the best practices movement that Pat Afterheide and Peter Yassi have spearheaded is a very interesting example, because if they're successful, there will be no court cases. There will be no formal decision making. People will just behave differently and succeed in doing it. I think there is no such thing as the market. There are many different kinds of markets and many types of non-market private arrangements, and all of these are the products of law and policy. None of them pre-exist law and policy. They are made, not born. And I think we could start trying to get used to talking that way. Some of the things that have come up earlier are very interesting to me, like maybe making private censorship a legally valid issue. It's not going to happen next week, but anything's possible. Making advertising support understood as a policy choice, or as a political choice, if you want, or perhaps an infrastructure decision. Are we going to pay for our media like Wikipedia, or are we going to do it like Facebook? That's a policy decision, not something that just happens. Maybe it's, call it an infrastructure decision. And I think that may be more useful. Well, I'm more interested in thinking along those lines than, say, engaging in media monopoly discourse. I'll leave it there.
I'm Jacob Sullum. I write for Reason Magazine, and I write a lot about civil liberties issues, in particular freedom of speech. So that's the aspect of telecom policy that interests me the most, I guess. And in terms of distinctions based on conduits, one of the things that seems crazy to me about current policy is that we continue to have this distinction between broadcast on the one hand, where you can regulate the content, and basically everything else where you can't regulate the content. I don't think that distinction was ever valid, and it certainly isn't valid now. When you know, if you watch television, you can't tell when you're looking at a broadcast station versus a cable station versus a satellite station versus, you know, streaming or whatever. My kids don't even know what that means. They don't know what broadcast means. To them, it's all, you know, different options, different entertainment options. So that seems crazy to me. I'm interested in those kinds of arbitrary distinctions that the law draws and the justification for them. And then in terms of media policy, I was saying that basically my position is that I'm against it. So I'm kind of the token libertarian here, but I do feel as a consumer that I'm getting more options than ever before. And so I have half a dozen different TV services, and I have moved from one to another. I used to be a Time Warner customer. I left them because they kind of sucked. And I went to Dish Network, and that worked out okay. We had these wonderful discounts at the beginning, but then the price went up, and their service was spotty. Now I'm with the AT&T U-verse. And again, it's a really good deal initially, and the prices will go up once the initial discounts, but then I can always move again, and there's always another option. And you have, in addition to all the various, you know, television services, you've got Roku, and you've got various other set-top boxes that are streaming whatever you want, basically, from the internet. And they've got their own channels within that service. So to me, there's all kinds of options when it comes to, you know, from the consumer's point of view. Whereas when I was a kid, we had basically three channels plus PBS, if you counted that. And it's amazing to me. Somebody was talking about TiVo earlier. I had a TiVo box, and that was like an amazing technology to me. Because it was something I don't even have to be concerned with, you know, what channel something's on. I can just discover something and have it recorded for me. I think it's a wonderful development. You know, and obviously those ideas have been incorporated into the DVRs offered by various companies. So I think, in contrast to a lot of people here, it's a great time to be a consumer of media, if you want to call it that, or a viewer or whatever. And I'm skeptical of the notion that there is such a thing as the public interest at all, as distinct from individual interests. And I guess I'm with Mark Fowler on that they, you know, the public interest is what interests the public. But we can talk more about that. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Yagolowicz. I'm from XBiz. This year marks my 20th year as a webmaster. I've been with XBiz for 13 years since its inception. Was an early part of bringing internet access to the Virgin Islands, working through that, and an early evangelist, going door-to-door to businesses, telling them what email was and how this new web thing was going to change the way they did business. And since, I'm very active in studying the policy, social, political, and legal aspects of adult entertainment in the online venue. And I'll comment, because I have a great interest in this broadband ubiquity of access. I live in rural Northern California, where my internet comes across a radio, and I have a 1 megabit connection. It's the best I can do because of bandwidth capping with the other options. So I would love, you know, they can merger all they want. Come to my neighborhood.
So you don't have six choices.
I have one choice.
You've got to go to Dallas. We have the.
No, I like my quality of life. I just don't like my quality of internet. And I'm here to provide some additional data points and a contrarian view on a lot of what you've heard here. So,
excellent.
And I'll be your token right-winger Republican. So,
always happy to have a Republican. My father is one.
Some of your best friends, right?
Some of your best friends. I kept trying to bring a Fox News clip in, and I kept getting blocked from doing that. So I'm
a big fan of Bill O'Reilly. I'll say it here on stage.
I'm a fan of Shep Smith. There you go. So do we have immediate thoughts about Comcast? I mean, is the sky falling? Is this just more of the same, no one's surprised? Are there larger stakes for consumers? So we got an awful lot of, this is great for consumers, right? So how do we feel about those conversations?
I can jump in just on you know, so we're supposed to be sort of linking these issues of content and conduit. I think the one thing that we should remember as we think about a merger like this is the extent to which current strategy is to continue to try to tether content and conduit. Some of you may be familiar with the TV everywhere model that many of the, you know, cable operators are trying to you know, to impose, where in order to access your content on mobile platforms, online, etc., you have to maintain your you know, traditional you know, wireline subscription, and you use your cable subscription then to access this content. And it's something that's easier to, of course, maintain if you are as vertically integrated as some of the large cable operators are, and that they own their networks. But what's interesting is to think about those networks that aren't part of a vertically integrated cable system. You know, what is the likelihood of them, you know, breaking ranks and going ahead and making their content available directly, you know, for, you know, on whatever sort of pay model they think might work for them, but essentially upsetting an apple cart that's been a very lucrative apple cart for everybody involved for quite some time. So, you know, I think that's part of this conversation about this kind of merger that is important, because it is that sort of content conduit, you know, connection that, that, you know, is, again, some people find very troubling that, you know, why do I have to keep this cable subscription to access truly everything that I want to see when I'd rather go over the top or mobile, et cetera.
And can I just point one example for the students of this is You go to the Olympics, you want to watch the Olympics, you go online. The Olympics is aired by NBC at prime time, right? But when you go online, you have to enter your cable subscription and password to view all of that content, which otherwise you can get, you know, free during prime time. So that's a TV everywhere model, where the basic requirement is a cable subscription to view content, even content you normally would perceive as being not part of cable.
And then the other thing, and you know, someone like Harold, maybe you've probably had this thought already, which is, to me, I can't imagine from an advocacy standpoint this merger coming at a better time. You know, someone talked before about, you know, sort of this interesting situation that arose in this country in 2003 when everyone was sort of united and mobilized on this issue of media ownership. Between the network neutrality decision and this proposed merger, this seems to me as the potential kind of perfect storm scenario that could actually, again, sort of re-engage people who've become disengaged from some of these issues. So if I was an advocate, I would be trying to figure out a way to leverage these two issues into, you know, a focus, because, of course, you know, the net neutrality issue is, and then the extent to which, you know, we have that is directly related to, you know, the scope and reach and market power of you know, of a large cable system.
So it's an opportunity.
I would say, from an advocacy standpoint, you know, if it's going to happen, this is a good time for it to happen, because I think it's a chance to, again, it's a, you know, a couple of issues that individually maybe don't really engage folks, but when they are considered in combination, I think people can better appreciate or sort of, you know, care about the ramifications.
Well, I think there's probably an understanding that eventually, if we have enough monopoly, it doesn't matter what happens with net neutrality.
Hold on, pondering that for a second. That's yeah, can you just say a few more words?
So, if we were to have a situation where you essentially don't have an option because your service, maybe all your services, are being bundled together through one provider, because with these natural monopolies, that's where they would go if they weren't regulated, right? I think we can agree that without any regulation, we would eventually have the cable overlord.
No.
So in a scenario where you
yeah,
have the cable overlord, yeah. Then you have a situation where net neutrality doesn't matter because they can set the baseline price for everyone where they want to lock certain parties out.
So the idea of a natural monopoly, and you guys can fill this out for me if you need to, but again, for students, so the historical area behind this is that there was a lot of infrastructure that had to be built for some of these communications technologies, all of those telephone poles, all of those wires. Same thing with cable. You had to wire these cities. It was a very complicated process. And that to make it economically feasible, especially to wire areas where it may not be economically beneficial, like the rural areas we've been talking about, you grant, a municipality grants a natural monopoly or concedes a natural monopoly to a company, because the only way you consider it economically viable is to give them this sense of, okay, it's going to cost you a lot up front, but there will be payoffs in the end because you won't constantly have someone else nipping at your heels. Is that the way to describe it?
We had that kind of natural monopoly. We also said we treated it as a common carrier.
Right.
So, but, if we have that kind of monopoly and they are actually, you know, have all the full discretionary powers of a programmer, that's a scarier, you know, kettle of fish.
Right, but we do have a fundamental disagreement amongst people whether there is competition or there is not, whether there is a monopoly or whether there is an awful lot. I mean, this is a pretty fundamental element that we can't agree upon, which it seems like it's difficult to move forward.
Well,
but
let me just address the natural monopoly point. I mean, you know, there's a natural monopoly and there's a government-awarded monopoly, and they might say, we think this is a natural monopoly, so we're going to make it a government-awarded monopoly. I mean, that's what they did, you know, with the local cable franchises, even though in principle you could have had competition with that, and that had to be opened up later on. So some of the things that look like they're natural monopolies, there's no other way of doing this, turn out not to be in the end. And I can choose from different power companies now. Now, granted, there's the infrastructure there, right, which is separate from who's producing the power, but still, that was like unimaginable when I was a kid, that you could choose your power company. You didn't like somebody's prices, or you didn't like the mix of sources that they use. If you want to go green, there's a company for that. If you want to get it cheaper, there's a company for that. If you want to get the really cool thermostat, right, there's a company for that. So things that we thought had to be monopolies, it turns out they don't. So I'm very skeptical of that idea. I'm not saying there's no such thing, but I think you really have to take a look at it. Also, a big part of it is, how do you define the market?
Right, so if the market is just cable TV, right, it's very different from saying the market is entertainment, right, which you can get from all these different conduits. And right now, we already have several different kinds of pipes coming to the house, into homes, whereas we used to have, you know, just one that we thought of as serving entertainment up, and we've got over-the-air of various kinds. So to me, that's all the same market, right? And it's, you could have no TV service, strictly speaking, at all, but you've got internet access, you can get streaming video, and it's much the same thing. You can get discreetly recorded things on CDs or DVDs or other media. And to me, that's all the same market. Right?
But that's where it gets tricky with media. And that's where I always think there's this slippage when we try to sort of impose economic models on media. Because I like Justified. There is no perfect substitute for Justified, that show. So if I can't get it, if I can't get Boston Red Sox games, there's no perfect substitute for that. I mean, that's the unique thing about media content. You know, it's not a commodity in that way. From a consumer standpoint, you know, access to one programming stream, you know, Netflix sucks. I like actually Amazon because Amazon has more movies. So they're not perfect substitutes for me.
Well, I agree with you about Justified, but not so much about, what was it, Red Sox games?
Red Sox games.
I have no interest in that. But you're definitely right about Justified. But yes, that's true. There's no perfect substitute for it, but there are... You know, there is competition for your attention and for your entertainment dollar,
right,
and you may find some other show that is not exactly the same. But
my means of accessing, you know, that show are limited. So I don't care if there's six providers. If only one, you know, they're
right,
not.
Well, that's based on the licenses that the people who create it, right, are awarding, which is somewhat different. Right. I mean, those are content creators as opposed to the people providing the conduit, right? Are we worried about that too?
We are. Let's let Tom get his comments.
Yeah, there is a whole universe of discussion here, and I remember Nick Garnham, the British media Marxist, once sighed in a talk he was giving and said, you know, toting up a list of the top five or six corporations that own most of the media is not the same as an analysis. And he mentioned, you know, Herb Schiller, another great media Marxist, great speaker, in the 1980s, was all exercise about Gulf and Western buying up, I even forget which is some movie studios and maybe a network, they were moving into media. And, it turned out to be not such a good deal for Gulf and Western, and, you know, it didn't work out. And I'll say this, that I think, you know, I'm interested in making a fairer, freer, less harsh, more democratic world. And I think if we have a great success, which I'll support this, you know, reporters call me outside of this room, I'm going to be like, this is an evil thing, this merger.
I'm a reporter.
You know, if we have a huge success, I don't expect it to really get us any further towards the world I want. Because what's going on is more a symptom of the things that I'm disturbed about than an initial cause. Ownership is a reflection of deep structural things about how we organize things like property and communication and, you know, what we value, what we take for granted, how we give power. And that's for me, comes out of a complicated, embedded, you know, centuries-old set of practices. And so the media monopolies complaint is at best a kind of sloppy shorthand. And I think, it's the real world is, what kinds of competition? There's corporate rivalry, which is it's not the same as, you know, full free market, open competition. There's I think most of the time what we're really worried about is oligopoly economics, which is its own very strange beast. And, you know, there's many brilliant and completely incommensurable theories of how do you explain oligopoly economics. But it's this strange dance of the elephants. I think Phil, you're right. This is an opportunity, and because I am interested in making people aware that the media doesn't have to be the way it is, and that it does. These are political decisions that people should have a choice over, push it. This is because it's something that many, you can have a coalition around this. But I think over the long haul, we need better language, and the eyes on the prize is something quite distinct from just a slight increase in the intensity of the enforcement of antitrust law.
I'd like to touch on that real quick with the monopoly. Jacqueline brought up the bundling issue. I'm not concerned with cable companies joining in, even though the offer is popular with consumers. It's you get your cable, internet, phone access together. And I think that concentrates too much power over all your communications technologies in the hands of one or two corporate masters. And that's not, I think that threat is far more, even though your policy then may go against consumer demand, it's a better plus overall socially, not to let that kind of power concentration occur.
Especially, I'm sure a lot of us have been in this boat when you find your cable bill goes up if you refuse phone service, and, and you're being sort of force fed a product you don't even want. That's to me that was I always thought that was going to resonate more as far as
the monopoly issue, even if
to bundling.
Even if it isn't actually in place, that the companies want this, and that was my big fear is they see the AOL those days and want that walled garden where they control the content, the advertising, the condo, everything in one little package. And Facebook is about as close as you get to that now, where they have such a huge market share. That's their own ecosystem, and they can set their own policy, and the rest of the discussion is, moot for the company. Yeah.
The idea of an ecosystem is interesting. I mean, policy often just unrolls in day-to-day life, small decisions that happen that gradually grow. So the idea that people are not upset about your cable, your phone, all of that coming together, I think that all came very slowly, right? And we're at the point now where we don't actually need our phone. Privileged people do not need their phone in the same way. I feel like...
You mean a landline, right?
A landline, yeah. Right. There were moments when people would have reacted strongly. But at this particular moment, as they unveiled it, they unrolled it slowly. And now the irony is you get the phone from the cable company to get the lower price, you don't own an actual phone. I did this. I don't know how many of you do this, but my roommate has a phone that rings and nobody answers it ever. It's just, this is like one of these crazy deals. With this idea of Netflix, like what I'm thinking about with Netflix, one of my concerns with them is that, so they're the outsider. They have this alternative model that isn't based on advertising. It's a price point the industry's not thrilled with, but for consumers, it's like, oh, here's this new entrant, right? Netflix doesn't have any movies, right? Why doesn't Netflix have any movies? It doesn't have any movies because content providers have decided to freeze them out. This is a form of policy making. This is a form of engagement that is actually shaping the content we can get, the services we enjoy. So when we talk about multiple layers, like we've talked a lot about government, but talking about these corporations, when you talk about Comcast, it's very easy as an opportunity in some ways because everybody hates the cable company. But when I bring up Apple trying to limit access to adult content, or when I try to bring up Google, I use Chrome because it really is fastest, but I am trapped inside an ecosystem that is based on exploiting my data, privacy issues that have come up. So in terms of corporations that we're talking about, and what are they policymakers today? Does this have broad implications for the kinds of content we have options, but we don't have options to adult content in the same kinds of ways? Where are the outsiders coming in offering that through Fios?
Address that? I guess the distinction that I draw, which not a lot of people here do draw, is between private power and government power, which to me is very important. I don't get upset when the cable company says, bundle your phone service with your internet service and it'll be cheaper. I think that's a good deal. I might want to do that. I don't necessarily have to do that, right? And in fact, I haven't. I have various different companies providing me different services because that's what made sense to me. I've got Vonage for my work phone. I've got my wife got some kind of thing that works off of Sprint for the theoretically a landline for the home line, and I've got a TV service from Viewers, but then I also have Netflix and all that other stuff coming over Roku. So I've got lots of different options, and to me, that's a good thing. I don't feel that they're offering me of a package deal or a bargain is constraining me anyway. In any way, that's offering me another option. I don't see that as predatory. So that might be shocking. I don't know. But right. So, but I think that really is a crucial distinction, is that ultimately they cannot force you to do something. They can't put a gun to your head. They can't threaten you to put you in prison. Right? They can persuade you. They can offer you terms that might be attractive or might not. And you're not going to get everything you want necessarily. Right? Like you said, Netflix has some things that are very good. They've got really old TV series that you forgot you ever saw, but it's delightful to come across them again. They don't have, you know, a super selection of recent movies for sure. That's one thing. So you have other options where you can pay more, say through Amazon, and get a bigger selection of recent movies. You can't always get everything you want, but there is a lot to choose from, and that to me is the important thing.
No, they can't put a gun to your head, but they can make your life really, really hard. And the, you know, in thinking about policy as an ecosystem, one of the important aspects of the ecosystem of policy is that segment of the media sphere that is not buying into it. In other words, piracy is one of the escape valves. It is one of the competitors that can keep a Comcast, I won't say honest, but honester. And coming back to the question I was asking at the end of the last panel, we ran out of time, this whole issue of anonymity and privacy and security and so forth, one of the reasons that I find that particularly important to advocate for is because I want to champion, you know, this is, I want to champion the importance of piracy and the importance of that, the what's currently defined as illegality within an ecosystem to keep the legitimate players, that is, those who have been able to achieve legitimacy through money, through whatever political influence and political power, to keep them on their toes, keep them honest, and so forth. So they would love to jail the pirates, right? They would love to jail those who tap cable service and don't pay for it. They've found technological workarounds for that, and they are well on their way to and they're perpetually attempting to rewrite international law and national law and to rewrite the technology to eliminate that particular part of the ecosystem. I think we need to incorporate into our understanding of policy the critical role that they play, that outside pressure from what are currently considered illegitimate forces.
I mean, the term jailbreaking your phone is an right. Yeah. This puts this within this kind of criminal activity realm.
But I think that we also have to consider that in their efforts to fight the pirates, some of the content owners have ended up setting really dangerous legal precedents. And they've also used other tactics that are really concerning. For instance, we've seen with ICE, which is customs enforcement, partnerships with content owners where without warrants they're seizing websites. So this is the type of activity that we wouldn't have seen 10 years ago. We're also seeing that instead of asking conduits to take what's called ex post action, where we see something bad that happens and then they have to take action to correct it, we're seeing a move towards ex ante action, sort of like in that example that I talked about in Turin, Italy, where now they're pushing the conduits to screen all content because there might be piracy occurring. And so I think that's the dangerous side, that there's just this black and white dichotomy, all piracy is evil, so we will slam that down so hard that we don't care what goes out with it.
Right, and then that comes back to a question of what you consider, or how you're thinking about political forces, because I absolutely agree. At the same time, it's making the unholy alliance between, say, the content industries and our police, you know, our police force, our military, our customs. It's making that unholy alliance visible. It's something that now we can attack. It's something that we can work on. In Columbus, Ohio, which is close to where I live, a couple weeks ago, somebody was hauled out of the theater by the FBI because he was wearing Google glasses, right? And they were afraid that he was, right? And somehow the FBI was called and responded, right? They actually drove down to this theater in Columbus, Ohio, and like, okay, let's get this guy, and they interrogated him for 4 hours. So I'm not sure that's, you know, that's not a good thing. It's a bad thing for him. It's, but at least we can see some of those political economic connections made visible. And as long as we are putting pressure on that system, then, yeah.
Let me just briefly say, I think copyright is actually very problematic, largely because it's so arbitrary. And it's not, to me, it is distinct from other kinds of rights, because it has to be defined by law. It has an arbitrary, term that can be retroactively extended for no apparent reason after people are long dead. And, so it has justification is sometimes a moral justification. You will sometimes hear that, but more often is pragmatic. We need to have this because it encourages innovation and creation and so forth. So I think it's very problematic. I don't like to see any of these like criminal penalties attached to something like creating a technology to get around somebody's, copy protection, that kind of thing, or having the FBI come in and have the guy in the movie theater. But you could imagine a system where you had something like the current exclusivity, at least for new releases, which was purely contractual and technical. It was done without any kind of copyright law. It was simply, we have this arrangement with you, we have certain technological protections that stop people from copying, at least over the short term, and you get all your money up front to the extent that you can, and then people are free to copy to the extent that they can. Right? So you can imagine a system like that. There still would be this element where Netflix might not have those movies right away because they don't have the license, but you wouldn't have people being thrown in jail over that.
No, I'm going to disagree with you, Jacob.
Somebody should.
Since the high watermark 2007-2008, in that range, up to 80% of adult industry revenues have dissipated in a bloodbath. Piracy is not the only factor involved in that. There's a perfect storm of economic malaise and other issues. But the real threat that it faces, organized criminal piracy, not merely sharing your one CD that you bought, is a huge issue, and it really needs to be addressed. And that's a policy matter for a lot of for groups, because they would rather take a step back from that and not necessarily pursue pirates. And that was an issue with going after end users with the litigation problems. Some attorneys had gotten together with various rights holders and pursuing pirates one at a time like that. They did it in a way that, I wish Jeff had spoken about that, where they were really spanked hard by the judges about the way that they were doing these predatory lawsuits. And you won't see that, apparently, again, because of the problems with that. So, you're looking at, in that way, the law and the legal process is affecting the policies of the adult companies as they look for ways to mitigate this blood loss from the copyright violations.
Although, wasn't there just a piece about the Matthew McConaughey film that's up for an Oscar? Individual people that have torrented that film are being prosecuted. Did anyone else see this article? So, which I thought went away with Napster, right? I thought that was such a disastrous strategy that people decided going after individuals actually breeds sympathy, because then you have the big guy going after the little guy.
And in adult, there was a lot of shame factor involved where, you were going to be outed to everybody, right? And if you didn't pay up now, send us the check. And that's...
watching porn and you're cheap.
Yeah. There's a lot of problems with that, because then you're really alienating customers. And, that hits the public perceptions, because then people are afraid to be your customer because they don't want to accidentally do the wrong thing. And that becomes one more justification for avoiding that media type, because you're afraid you're going to get that letter and then all your neighbors will know whether you did anything wrong or not.
Well, are there broader stakes for consumers of adult content in terms of their actual internet, their browser that they use? So I'm at home, I pulled something up online, I'm using my Google Chromecast to put it on my TV so I can see it in bigger form. Google now knows everything I've done. They know how I'm using it. They know how long I've watched it. I mean, do those kind of stakes come up often in terms of privacy or the potential liability of the kinds of content you might access?
More so. Browser technology, there's safe surfing modes, and there's a lot of different plugins and some specific browsers that are made for surfing adult content. But, the privacy issue is a red herring. We have an old saying, all roads lead to Virginia. between Google and NSA and other agencies. There's nothing that's private on the internet. Even this, the whole rage with Bitcoin and all these anonymity of addresses, and you know, we're putting in ATM machines now. Well, they need to scan your passport or photo ID to be able to activate it. So even something that as a payment mechanism is so put out to be private, there is no privacy in there. Somewhere it links you to a specific number. And if it does that, then that can be accessed.
So. Well, I would have to disagree with you there. There have been, in recent years, a number of instances where there are copyright trolls rampant in the adult entertainment industry, where they're actually suing not the browsers, but the payment providers. They are going after PayPal and forcing PayPal to give up user information so that they can then go after those users. There was a big case where Liberty Media was saying to users, here's the deal. We promise not to sue you for stealing our porn if you pay us $1,000 for a subscription.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of bad business practices, and this is why this gets clamped down. Where I've seen more of this recently, though, going after payment providers, is in the pursuit of illegal file lockers, the cyber lockers and all, as a copyright infringement tool. And there's one, Adult King, goes by the name Robert King out of Australia, has a very successful campaign, StopFileLockers.com, where he's been very good about just banging on PayPal's door and eliminating a lot of these payment mechanisms. And there's been a lot of backlash because the pirate community, why are you interfering with our right to have everything for free? And, well, people paid for that and need to recover their investment. And it's not just free. It's not air.
Right. It's not free, but there are probably better ways than attacking the payment intermediaries.
Well, I guess a good question for somebody who knows more about this than I do is, how do we get to the point where you can get music track for under $1 and it's completely unconstrained, right? It used to be copy protected. It was a huge hassle. Every time you wanted to play it on a different device, you could only play it on maybe two more devices, and it kept asking, kept checking with the server for permission. Now it's completely unconstrained. The music industry is still making money somehow, right? That model, even though there are lots of people out there who are getting music for free, they're copying people's stuff off their MP3 players and just getting the files transmitted to them. But somehow that works, right? So you could say piracy is rampant, right? And yet there are still people like me who are willing to pay 99 cents or 89 cents or whatever for the track because it's convenient. And you can add it to your collection, and especially the fact that you can move it from device to device. You don't have to recreate your music collection each time you get a new computer. So that seems like that could be a model. People are getting something for their money, even though there are other people out there getting it for free. They're not getting exactly the same thing. Right. It's not quite as convenient, right? So why can't that work for porn?
I think if you asked recording industry executives, they would tell you that they lost the battle. Actually, they probably would tell you they lost the war. Apple came in with iTunes. It found a price point that worked. It had a distribution mechanism where they largely had a lot of control over it, and they set the terms. And because the music industry had been so embroiled in trying to deal with piracy and dealing with other things, I don't know that they were quick enough to counter, right? And they were kind of desperate to find a model. So I think they seeded the ground because this was at least legitimate. And even we see it playing out again now with Spotify versus Pandora, who actually do have sort of different models. I think Spotify is a little better for companies than Pandora is, but we're talking 0.06 cents per play, or that's probably not the exact number, but it's less than a penny for each play. So some people are making money, but especially on that model. It's the fact that I, listened to a particular album 400 times, so that very large band that everyone knows is doing okay. But, this long tail of people is getting 0.06 cents for the three plays for the three people. I'm just saying that I wouldn't necessarily concede that the music industry is an example of success. And I think that TV and film have tried to find alternative models. And that's why they're still resisting Netflix, because it's a price point that actually undermines their system. It undermines their relationships with long-term relationships with distributors. And so I think we're seeing this playing out, But I don't know that we know the end for other industries.
The profit is being savaged out of that music industry, too, and that's why it's a benefit for us who like older bands, because all the rock guys that thought they were retired now have to go back on the road, because that's where they're making their money, is in the live performances. It's no longer in that revenue stream from this. And I'll just add one more point about why that's something I've wanted for a long time, the iTunes of porn. One of the big issues that we have is access to micropayments, and this is a policy issue. The banking industry, the card associations in particular, Visa, MasterCard, hold the adult entertainment industry to a much higher standard than they do the mainstream industry, mainstream retail and all. And what you're looking at is not only excessive fees to set up accounts, different types of fees that other merchants aren't going to pay, but we also have much lower chargeback thresholds. Whereas the percentage of people that just call up and say, hey, I never authorized this, we're down below 1% in some markets. And you don't see that in mainstream. And, you know, the different fraud rates where the actual fraud is really not happening in adult, but it's adult that gets, you know, the thumb on it to really go over and above to comply with these kind of policy decisions. So,
I mean, I'm wondering about, you know, there's so many different ways about talking about these details. And we do kind of use words like, well, they need this to survive. Well, no, they don't need it to have food on the table. And they actually don't need to get a return on their investment. We kind of build the world so certain people get returns on their investment and other people don't. And we live in a deeply mixed economy. There's all the diaper changing, well, most of the diaper changing done in the world is done for free. It's free, unwaged labor. And recipes are not copyrightable. And, it's not like chefs all over the country are starving because right. they can't, it's, and, you know, fashions are right. at this point not copyrightable. And the fashion industry is not collapsing. And mostly, I think what the business model, the Silicon Valley, the era of the last 30 years of watching the explosion of Silicon Valley has created a kind of actual business model where what you want to do is try to establish a standard and then exploit that standard. That was Microsoft's strategy. And it's either kind of monopoly or oligopoly, depending on how you define it. But that's what everybody wants to do. That's what everybody's afraid of Netflix doing, and that's what Netflix wants to do to them. And, you know, everybody wants to be the kingpin in the center of it all and kind of control the standards because that's where you can maximize profit. It's not a model of competition. Our economy does not... It's at best ambivalent about competition. I mean, and there's the incentives to reduce competition and the behaviors that we reward that reduce competition are huge. And so it's, I love libertarian model and people who, particularly people who take it seriously, not people who just kind of dabble in it, but like the real the Reason magazine, I love it. I've never seen a good explanation for a solution to the problem of monopoly, that eventually little fish get eaten by the big fish and you get concentration. Like, and, you know, yeah, okay, new technologies come along and over time there's this shift, but it's a dance of the elephants. It's not this kind of wide open competition. And I wonder, as progressives, if there's other languages we can use to talk about this maneuvering. I mean, it's fascinating to talk about and important. That where we never say it's necessary, where we try to foreground the political nature of it, that all that we're talking about is a set of political choices about how to allocate resources and what kinds of things we're going to reward and what kind of things we're going to ignore. And in the media field, maybe thankfully, none of it is life and death. We're not healthcare. We're not welfare. We're not... disaster relief organizations, and so I think it's interesting precisely because it's about how to build a rich democratic world in a kind of positive way. That's the debate we're having here. It's not, and I think the left loves apocalyptic language, and it's getting so bad, and it's just getting worse. And just you wait until it gets so terrible that everybody rebels. I mean, that's it's actually 1848 language, but and
but
we still love
right
that.
Also. What? Well, Jack Valenti, he compared. What was the comparison he made about Boston the Boston Strangler?
Yeah.
That's right. The VCR is going to kill the film.
The left gets into its own kind of like, oh my God, it's so crucial. And sometimes when you're talking to reporters and so forth, or you're I won't say never use that language, but it often is not very illuminating of the complexity of what we're talking about.
But we still, you know, we do have the idea that was introduced in the last panel that communication is a human right, that telecom is a fundamental, essential form of expression, that the conduit is key and vital for the free exchange of ideas. And that's a pretty profound set of stakes, if we're going to return to the idea of what are the stakes here, you know, how big are they?
I guess I don't agree with that. That access to the internet, for example, is a basic human right. You have the basic human right to engage in a voluntary, you know, agreement with some guy who wants to provide that for you, for sure. But that's all based on property rights and freedom of contract. In terms of how do monopolies come about? We have to again distinguish between a natural monopoly, assuming such a thing exists, and right, something that where you're constraining competition by using government power. And of course, businesses love to do that; they do that all the time, and all kinds of sectors. So we have to distinguish between being pro-business or pro-corporation or whatever, and being pro-market. The market is a process, and I take you to be saying that the background rules of how this operates are arbitrary, or the government can decide to change them, right?
Yeah, I think there are.
I think you're
absolutely right. There's no natural monopolies. Well, at least in the area we're talking about, they don't have to be. I think very other arrangements. I think it's just the question is what are the rules of the game?
Okay.
And that I think is always going to be a set of political choice. There's no kind of.
But I would be careful about going too deep with that, because ultimately all of these rights that we care about are a function of property that we get to use, the first property being our own bodies, right? If you have a right to free speech, it's because you can use your body to talk about things, it's because you can use a pen and paper that you own, because you can use the computer you own to go online with the service that you bought in order to blog about whatever. Those are all, that's you exercising your property rights and your contract rights that grow out of property rights. And if we say that that is all only by the grace of government that we have those rights, then we really ultimately don't have any rights. If we can't use our bodies as we please and exercise dominion over things in the world that we, you know, acquire through free exchange, then we really can't exercise any of these rights that people tend to think of as being more important.
But can we talk about bringing privilege back in? So you have the children who, for school, for various reasons, need the computer, they need the internet, they need a variety of things. When they graduate, they need to be able to create a resume, they need to be able to go online and apply for things. Not everybody has access to wonderful broadband in their home. Stephen is another example of the rural problem, right?
Right. Well, I mean, there is a separate question of what do you do about poor people, right? I mean, they don't, you know, the technology may be available, but maybe they just can't afford it. Then you argue over whether that's a legitimate function to govern, either to provide this particular thing that we say everyone needs, or simply to give them the means through some kind of negative income tax or whatever to purchase, you know, to bring them up to the level of so they're not in poverty anymore. But to me, that's all the same question, though. It's a question of having the means to get what you want, and some things we define as being more important than others. You know, food and shelter are more important, even than internet access, I would argue. But that's all a question of you know, what do you do about the poor? And you can argue that it can be done, you know, the poor can be helped through private means. Doesn't mean the market per se takes care of it. It's not a financial motive. There are private methods of helping people. You know, libraries where people go online do not have to be run by the government, for example. You know, there is such a thing as privately run libraries. I mean, these things do exist. The government doesn't have to do everything. Just because something won't be supported through the usual market process where people are expecting a return on their investment doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Doesn't mean the government has to do it. There are lots of things that private arrangements can take care of even without a profit motive.
I think we've seen in the past similar arguments about schooling and education, but one of the great things about America is that it is a country where we don't have to worry that it's at the whim of some foundation who maybe will go under and then take that away. And the other thing we have to consider is it's not just about poor people, but about people who are disenfranchised in other ways, right? So the internet is global, but unfortunately sovereignty is more local than that. And we have all kinds of different ideas about whether internet access is a right or a privilege. We have different situations in China than we do here. And we're coming to an inflection point where, because all of these boundaries of the internet are essentially crashing together, right? Because there are more people who are trying to communicate with people in other countries, there's more commerce happening, we're going to have to come to some kind of global agreements about how the internet and access to the internet is going to be governed. We're going to have to start to come to agreements about how conduits, which, you know, Netflix right now is an American company, but that doesn't mean that people in Venezuela don't want to be accessing Netflix.
I don't know that we have been able to provide all of the answers for our wonderful day. We have shown that you can have a pretty good conversation together, though. So thank you to all of our panelists. We really appreciate you coming here. Thank you to all of you. It's been a wonderful day.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.